TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government, Part 2. This is a conversation between two authors who dedicated their work to revealing the undercover world of U.S. politics. David Talbot is doing it here in the form of a real-life spy thriller, The Devil's Chessboard, a book that is more intriguing than current fiction. Peter Dale Scott calls the invisible government the deep state, and he has written several books defining the term. Both are warning of placing ever more executive power into unaccountable agencies, such as the CIA, agencies that apparently can no longer be controlled by elected politicians. David Talbot is also the author of the New York Times bestseller Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. There he shows how the Kennedy administration was besieged, like none other before, by underground forces from the Pentagon, the CIA, the FBI, and the mob. David Talbot is founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon and was senior editor at Mother Jones magazine. Peter Dale Scott is a former diplomat for Canada, professor of literature emeritus at UC Berkeley, and an award-winning poet. His recent books include The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy, and Dallas 63, The First Deep State Revolt Against the White House. In the previous TUC radio program, you heard Talbot and Scott cover Alan Dulles, the man who shaped the CIA. Talbot quotes him as saying that democracy is too important to be left in the hands of mere people like you and me and our elected representatives. In the second part of their conversation, Scott and Talbot begin with the aftermath of World War II, where the future of wartime intelligence services and the future relations to the USSR and what became the Cold War are being decided. William Joseph Donovan was the wartime head of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. And President Truman resisted the conversion of the OSS into the CIA. However, Alan Dulles had different plans. He had rejoined Sullivan and Cromwell, a law firm with huge impact on international affairs and powerful corporate clients. Dulles also had close relations with the Council on Foreign Relations. Founded in 1921 and still very active today, it is a think tank specializing in U.S. foreign policy, headquartered in New York City. The CFR promotes globalization, free trade, reducing financial regulations, and supports regional trade blocs such as NAFTA or the TPP. So here's the conversation between David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott on the beginning of the CIA and its first successful covert operation.
Now, I'm going to jump ahead and look after the war. Alan Dulles is now back in, as a lawyer at Sullivan and Cromwell, and Truman has just told Donovan, no, you can't turn the OSS into a CIA. Truman did not want a CIA, and yet not only did we get a CIA, but Alan Dulles is designing it with the Council on Foreign Relations up in New York. How did that happen?
And Truman said he didn't want a Gestapo, is the way he put it.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How was New York able to tell Truman not only that he needed a CIA, but to give him a blueprint for it?
Well, in some ways, I think it was done without Truman's knowledge. As you know, this organization, the OPC,
right.
which was this purposely very bland title, I believe it stood for the Office of Policy Coordination, right. which of course means nothing. This was a
watch out for those bland titles.
Their first goal, of course, as part of their plan to roll back the New Deal and purge Washington of all New Deal sort of thinking, it was to get Tom Dewey elected in 1948. And we know, of course, Dewey did defeat Truman. No, he didn't. And so that Dewey was the Dulles Brothers man. He had run once before in 44 and lost. And everyone thought he was a shoo-in in 48. That Truman was kind of this hack from Missouri, wasn't well known, that the left wing of the Democratic Party had split away under Henry Wallace. And so they thought that, 48 was there for the Republicans picking. But he does get defeated in a stunning upset. And so the Dulles brothers, and Allen in particular, have to go to Plan B at that point. He was already picking out his drapes for the CIA's office. He had helped create the CIA in 1946.
Well, no, it was
signed into order. Yeah,
it was passed into law in 47,
right.
But the Dulles Committee recommendation was in 47.
Exactly.
A lawyer in Wall Street is telling the president what he should do for his...
Right. So Plan B always with these people was, okay, if you don't get your way electorally and you can't just take power in, kind of an out front way, is you do it behind the scenes. And so I think one of the key ways, and I know, Peter, you know a lot about this and you can fill in, is they did create this obscure, mysterious organization called the Office of Policy Coordination within the State Department under a guy named Frank Wisner, who was a longtime accomplice and colleague of Allen Dulles, a fellow Wall Street guy who had gone into the OSS like Dulles during World War II. And they were very close allies.
Can I give
Go ahead.
In book after book, you read the standard explanation, which, by the way, is true as far as it goes, just not the whole truth. The CIA was set up to gather intelligence, and then there were about 8 words in the National Security Act that said, and such other activities as the National Security Council shall from time to time direct. Didn't say that the CIA would be independently deciding what to do. Well, almost right away, they were faced with the Italian election of 1948. And the big American corporations faced expropriation in Italy. And they went to Washington, and Secretary of Defense Forrestal, who was another Wall Street banker, part of this milieu, he said, oh no, you bankers should handle that yourselves. And they started raising money among the bankers in New York City. And then Allen Dulles, who's only a private lawyer after all, said, no, that's wrong. The government has to do it. And Allen Dulles, who was not in the government, prevailed over Forrestal, who was. And so the CIA conducted its first covert operation. It pumped $20 million into the Italian election. And by the way,
to prevent the left and the communists
from taking defeat the left
power.
And have a government of Christian Democrats. That $20 million came from captured Nazi, I would say, SS funds. I believe that's a spin-off from Operation Sunrise, but I can't prove that. I could give you a good case, but I can't prove it. But that was the first operation. And then they said, well, we need an organization to conduct these operations. Now, the CIA was created by a statute, the National Security Act, along with the Pentagon, many other things. But the Office of Policy Coordination was just an executive order. It never had any kind of review from outside at all. And what it became almost immediately was sponsoring acts of violence in Eastern Europe. They like to talk about Albania because it was so small. They sent a team of 20 into Albania, and they were all killed because they were penetrated.
Because of Reinhard Gehlen, partly.
There was a war going on in the Ukraine that you rarely hear about, but the war didn't end in the Ukraine in 45. And I know this because when I was a Canadian consul in Warsaw, I personally had to issue a visa to somebody who came in from the Ukraine, had never been to Canada, but because he had been in that, he was a veteran of that war, Canada had agreed with the CIA to admit those people.
But Pete, if I could just interrupt. So the big picture here is that the Dulles faction of the Republican Party fails to win the Democratic 1948 election. It goes to Truman instead. And so then this Dulles group creates, basically, because they can't formally run the CIA, which this agency they've just created in 47, so they create an alternate CIA buried within the bowels of the State Department called the OPC under a Dulles crony, Frank Wisner, and they pursue a much more aggressive policy, I believe, of sabotage and a violent policy in Eastern Europe of not containment, as George Kennan has argued for in the State Department, but rollback.
Rollback, exactly.
Rollback. So in other words, they're trying to roll back communism through various forms of violent intervention. And I don't believe that Truman even was fully aware of all these activities that were going on under the banner of the Office of Policy Coordination.
Well, the OPC got out of control, wildly out of control. There was an episode in Thailand that we don't fully understand. What I believe happened was that somebody in the CIA was investigating the drug traffic there, and somebody from OPC was involved in supporting the drug traffic there because it was supporting an army in Burma and creating a lot of wealth to create a new Chinese middle class in Southeast Asia. So an OPC officer murdered a CIA officer. This is, I believe, there certainly was a what they call a Thailand flap, and it was investigated by the CIA Inspector General. And the recommendation was, well, we have to get this OPC under control, so we'll put it in CIA, and we'll put Alan Dulles in charge of it inside the CIA. Well, what happened was the opposite. Instead of the CIA controlling OPC, OPC moved into better quarters and took over the CIA, and that's the real importance of Iran, that Iran in 1953 was the kind of operation that OPC had been doing and now was doing under an agency that was authorized by statute. And so it was very important in that respect, I believe.
Right, and so again, to go back to kind of the big picture here, we have then the genesis of this militant rogue, as Senator Frank Churchlager called the CIA operation, even forming before Alan Dulles formally takes over the CIA after Eisenhower is elected in 52. And so he's all ready to go to hit the ground running. Basically, I think OPC then becomes the action arm of Alan Dulles' CIA during the 1950s.
It becomes what they call the Directorate of Plans, and later it got a more honest name, Directorate of Operations.
Right. So every president that Dulles supposedly is serving is being subverted in one sense or another. Truman, just to flash forward then, to 1963, and I'm sure we'll have some questions about the Kennedy era, writes this. How many people know about the Washington Post op-ed piece that Harry Truman wrote in December 1963, shortly after the assassination of President Kennedy? No,
it's
just a couple of people. All right.
Very important. Yeah.
Very important piece of American history. So Harry Truman, for some reason or other, we can speculate why, decides in that very fraught moment when the whole country is still in mourning over the events in Dallas to write this very explosive op-ed piece in the Washington Post, of course, the nation's capital's newspaper. And in it, he basically says that I've created a monster. I never meant to create a CIA that was as militant and aggressive and violent as the CIA has become. I wanted an organization that basically just coordinated intelligence for the White House and passed on the most important information to the White House. He did not want to create a organization that was threatening, as he said, democracies overseas, was creating all sorts of mischief in foreign countries, and most provocatively, he says, that has now become so out of control it's threatening our own democracy at home. Well, that was heavy language from a former president who had created the CIA, as I say, in this particular historical moment. Alan Dulles knew how threatening this was, because this allowed, of course, This is the way the American media works. It needs some cover to get brave. You never see the American media be brave on its own. So the former president had then gave a lot of columnists around the country working for different newspapers the sort of permission to also launch their own attacks on the CIA. And suddenly there's a wave of critical commentary in the American press about the CIA at this very fraught moment. Alan Dulles knew this couldn't stand, so he immediately starts, going to sort of the Washington power elite, Clark Clifford, the major power attorney who'd served in the Truman administration, and basically say, look, talk sense to Truman. He's off the reservation here. Get him to retract this amazing provocative op-ed. That fails, of course, because Harry Truman is famously a stubborn character. So Alan Dulles gets on an airplane and flies down to Independence, Missouri, meets with Truman at the Truman Library, and again, strong arms him. In typical Dulles way, he tries to charm him at first. Mr. President, you created this great institution. Surely you feel some sense of ownership here, and so on. That doesn't work. Then he does the next best thing. He flies back home, and he can't change the truth. He can't change reality, so in great CIA, style, he changes the record. He writes a letter to the general counsel of the CIA, Lawrence Houston, and says, I just came back from Missouri, I talked to Harry, and it was the most amazing thing. He had no recollection of this article he had written. It was as if he was senile. The old guy has gone off his rocker, and he wrote this thing, or someone wrote it for him, and he put his name on it. And so that goes down then within the CIA sort of official, history as what happened. And in fact, years later, you still see official CIA histories basically saying, well, yeah, some young aide to Harry Truman got this, bee in his bonnet and went off and attacked the CIA in this piece for the Washington Post and put the president's name on it, But it was clear that Harry Truman was in his right mind. He continued to take this position, this critical position about the CIA for the rest of his life in oral history, with the famous oral history he did with Merle Miller, in letters that he wrote to newspaper and magazine editors. So this is the way that Dulles operated.
Well, and unless anyone think that Harry Truman was some kind of lone nut, let's put this in perspective. At one of Eisenhower's last meetings in the White House, he said that he had tried to reform the whole intelligence industry and totally failed, and what he was leaving for the next president was a legacy of ashes. And when Dulles went to Independence, he knew that before he was assassinated, Kennedy was saying in the White House that he was going to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. Nixon, I'll skip Johnson, though I could talk about Johnson too, but very clearly with Nixon, it became a battle between Nixon and the then CIA, Richard Helms, who deserves, I think, more space in this story than you could fit into your book. But it was going to be Nixon or Helms, and Nixon, fearing Helms, banished him, as he thought, to Iran, and Helms in Tehran got in cahoots with the intelligence agencies of Iran, Saudi Arabia, and notably France, and the man who went was not, in the end, Helms outlasted Nixon. I definitely believe that Nixon is a casualty as a president of having challenged unsuccessfully the CIA. We don't have time for that now. But if we go on, Carter tried to challenge the CIA.
There's a theme here.
Yes, from the Bay of Pigs to the election of Reagan is a very crucial period in American history in which time after time the White House is opposing what I call the deep state, but let's just say the CIA. And time after time, the CIA wins until you have the Reagan Revolution, and we don't have that problem anymore because
they're one and the same.
Somebody like Obama is not in a position to say, I'm going to scatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. Presidents know they don't have that power.
Well, maybe can we have five more minutes before we open it up? I think it'd be great if Peter and I can talk just a little bit about the Kennedy era first, and then we can open it up. So the last third of my book, as you know, Peter, deals with the crucial Kennedy era. And as you say, JFK, in my estimation, is the only president, really, during the Dulles era, who does stand up to the Dulles forces and say, I'm drawing the line here. And he does this after the Bay of Pigs, the disastrous CIA-orchestrated invasion of Cuba, which I believe, I argue in the book, was meant to fail. And the CIA
meant it to require the White House to come in with support from the Navy and the... Yes, exactly.
Yes.
I agree.
And I think the CIA's own internal kind of autopsies that were done on the Bay of Pigs disaster basically say that.
They blame Kennedy for not having come in when he had said in advance he wouldn't.
No, but I mean the Kirkpatrick report, which was done by the Inspector General of the CIA, basically said Allen Dulles staffed this operation with C-level CIA people. It was doomed to fail from the very beginning. And I believe that was intentional because Allen Dulles, as Peter just said, wanted the invasion, which was going to end up as a debacle, to trigger an all-out U.S. military invasion. Because that by then they would knew that this young president was really in a bind. Oh, my God, this is going to be a huge humiliation. I have to send in the Marines now and the Air Force to save this thing. Kennedy shocks them, this young president, by saying, no, I told you I didn't want this to be a loud invasion, as you put it, and I'm pulling the plug on it. Well, that's the beginning of this enormous rupture between the Kennedy White House and his national security state, particularly with Allen Dulles. He threatens, as Peter said, to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. He does, as I detail in my book, have Arthur Schlesinger, his deputy in the White House, the Harvard historian who had an intelligence background. He'd served in the OSS. He begins to research the CIA and how it can be, if not splintered, how it can be broken up, how it can be put under more democratic control, and so on. And so these reforms are starting to be at least researched, if not implemented. And Dulles and his two top deputies are forced out of the CIA. But once again, Allen Dulles, as I argue in the book, doesn't get the memo. He goes home to Georgetown, and he amazingly continues to operate, even though he's been fired by the President of the United States, as if he's still Director of Central Intelligence. He continues to meet with his top deputies. He continues to formulate policy with them that undermines the Kennedy policy over and over again, as I show in the book. So again, this treasonous pattern where you have top intelligence officials openly defying the Kennedy presidency and secretly defying it, after he's fired, is just an amazing story.
Can I add just one detail to that? That's not in your book, but is in Tim Weiner's book, Legacy of Ashes. One of the people who was appalled at the CIA right after the Kennedy assassination was CIA Director John McCone, who had been put in there by Kennedy to try and get the CIA under control. Most of my life, I regarded John McCone as a complete right-winger representing the oil industry, not to be trusted. But there's a quote from McCone in this Tim Weiner book that by March of 1964, which incidentally is the month that Richard Helms goes before the CIA and perjures himself about the CIA relationship to Oswald, I don't have time to get into that here, but what's interesting, McCone said, I want to get us out of the cloak and dagger business totally. In other words, he's agreeing with Truman that the CIA should not have a operational capacity, and coming from the director of the CIA, that gives you an idea of just how much...
We might have some disagreement over that, Peter, because I think Dulles pretty much felt that McCone was carrying on his policy, was kind of a front man who really didn't know what was happening within the deepest bowels of the agency, but basically a cold warrior like him. I mean, even the Kennedy brothers, I quote this from the White House tapes, say they fed up with him by a certain point. They go, he's a real bastard. You know, Bobby and Jack are talking. Because, as Schlesinger said, he was going around all over Washington talking about the Kennedys, McCone, and criticizing their policies and so on. So I don't see him as such a great guy, but I do think he was not prepared to be a Dulles. And I do think he probably had some, if he had known what was going on, right, the full extent of the assassinations and all
According
that.
According to Tim Weiner.
He was a Catholic who had, I think, some moral,
yes,
you know.
Yes, he was on record that you don't assassinate people. He was talking about him.
Yeah,
but
I agree with that.
But one other fact is that in the afternoon of November 22nd, McCone went from the CIA to talk to Bobby about his brother has just been killed an hour earlier. It's a very momentous moment. And
he says, did your guys kill him?
Yes, exactly. We don't know the content of the McCone RFK conversation, but right
after... He asked the wrong guy, because McCone doesn't know about the assassination
operation.
Yeah,
that's what I'm trying to say. We know the content because Bobby then called in his Cuban right-hand man, Harry Ruiz Williams, and said, one of your boys did it. And that must have come from McCone. And that evening, very late on the evening of, I don't know if you know this actually, late on the evening of November 22nd, McCone learns for the first time that the CIA had been working with the mafia to assassinate Castro.
But this is really important. Okay, and we can leave it at this and then open up. So in other words, the CIA, in the oldest conspiracy theory there is, immediately, John Kennedy's body is warm yet, and the CIA is putting out through all their media assets, the word all around the world, Castro did this. Castro is behind the assassination of President Kennedy. They're still doing it to this day. Politico ran an appalling piece about a month ago by Phil Shannon, a former New York Times reporter, in which he again carried water for the CIA and said that, you know, Castro did it. Which is
based on a CIA release.
Based on a CIA
which is,
release.
To me, a masterful piece of
disinformation. We can go into why Fidel had nothing to do with it, but...
This is all obstruction of justice, by the way. This
but at
is
the same time
case.
That the CIA is trying to pin this on Castro, Bobby Kennedy, the Attorney General of the United States, a man who probably knew more about the dark side of power because of his own investigative background than any other public figure at the time, and of course, because it was his brother who had been murdered, had the biggest investment in getting at the truth. He's saying within an hour, hearing about what happened in Dallas, he's confronting his anti-Castro friend, Harry Ruiz Williams, who Peter just mentioned, and saying one of your guys did it. In other words, someone who's part of the CIA anti-Castro operation killed my brother.
Okay, you know, you and I could go on and on, but maybe it's there are people here who want to ask a few questions.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour conversation about David Talbot's new 2015 book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Talbot spoke with Peter Dale Scott, one of the eloquent researchers and authors on the deep state that is hidden beneath the visible so-called democracy. They met at the Mechanics Institute Library in San Francisco on December 2nd, 2015. The audience included many writers and also whistleblowers, including Daniel Ellsberg. Come back when TUC Radio returns for a very lively and informative exchange of questions and answers. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.